the Long Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. This year, April 1st is April Fool's Day. Might not be what people have top of mind. Rents are due after a month of little to no income for some residents and business owners. Plus, it's Census Day, the critically important population count. We'll hear how census outreach is going in historically undercounted areas, especially with the challenge of the coronavirus pandemic. That and more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for being here. It's April 1st, and not only April Fool's Day, it's Census Day, and we're going to get to that in about 20 minutes. But first, the governor's daily briefing. Earlier this afternoon, Gavin Newsom revealed new data about the spread of COVID-19 in the state. And he said hospitals will likely exceed their surge capacity of 50,000 by around mid-May. And even with the distancing, the state might need up to 27,000 more ICU beds.
The good news is we have time. And that's why it's incumbent of all of us to utilize this time thoughtfully and judiciously. And what I mean by that, continue to practice safe physical distancing. Stay home, connect with others, make sure we're doing the neighbor-to-neighbor program, which we discussed yesterday, making sure we're checking in on our seniors, but no greater impact on changing that curve, buying us more time to prepare for this surge and for that peak than physical distancing.
Now, given that, Newsom says kids will not be returning to schools in the near future. Online learning will continue. If your child is still in need of a laptop to do this, we have information on how to get one on our website. That's laist.com. That's laist.com. Well, believe it or not, it is April, and because it is the first of the month, today we're reporting on what residents and small businesses are doing about rent during this pandemic. Many have lost jobs or have had work put on hold. KPCC's Emily Guerin talked to small business owners about the uncomfortable conversations they're having or maybe even not having with their landlords about making that rent payment. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks, A.
Now, okay, let's start with the rules around eviction and rent right now. On Friday, Governor Newsom announced a statewide ban on evictions for renters who cannot pay rent due to COVID-19. I understand that does not apply to businesses, right?
Right. So that means it's up to cities to decide whether or not to pass some kind of protection for small businesses that can't pay rent right now. And some cities have done this, like Los Angeles and Long Beach, but a lot of cities have not.
Okay. So we're getting a lot of questions from listeners about whether they have to pay rent right now. What do these commercial eviction bans actually mean?
So, yes, you do have to pay rent. You will have to pay your back rent eventually. And it kind of depends where you are, how much time you have to pay it back. So in Los Angeles, businesses have 3 months after the coronavirus emergency ends to pay their rent back. In Long Beach, they have until November 30th. But some business owners that are operating in high rent areas, they're already worried that they're just not going to be able to pay it back.
It's not easy to run a fabric store in the West Side. Like every month, it's like we have to be really careful about how we do things so we could make the rent.
That's Jack Jacob Sapar. He runs Fabric Planet in Venice, and his landlord has already reached out to him and offered to let him pay half of April's rent, but he's worried about paying it back.
Now, Emily, what kind of conversations are business owners having with their landlords right now?
So some people I talked to said their landlords were requiring them to submit proof that their business was actually affected by coronavirus before they agreed to any kind of rent deferment. Some people said their landlords were still expecting them to pay in full today for April's rent. And then other people told me that they thought their landlords were actually just ignoring them.
We had not heard from him, called him, texted him, emailed him, zero. It's just radio silence.
That's Jeanette Goldstein. She runs Jeanette Bras, which is a bra fitting boutique. They have 4 locations in LA County and 1 in Atlanta. And full disclosure, she is an underwriter at KPCC. And as of yesterday, Jeanette had not heard from one of her landlords yet.
Wow. Of course. Now, commercial landlords are business owners, too. So how is this affecting them?
Yeah, so I tried to talk to a bunch of commercial landlords, and it was difficult to get them on the line. So if you're a landlord, you own business space, and you want to talk to me, please get in touch. I did speak with Mike Brennan, though. He's a lawyer who represents landlords, and he said,
the sentiment I hear is that everybody is being very compassionate towards their tenants. Believe me, that's their cash flow. They don't want empty buildings. Nobody's running out to evict these people.
But he said that landlords are worried that if unpaid rent builds up, their tenants will never be able to pay it back.
And that's the same concern the fabric store owner you talked to had. You know, it sounds like landlords and business owners are both in a similar boat when it comes to worrying about back rent.
Yeah, and I think the businesses that are especially worried right now are the ones whose business model just does not work with social distancing, like yoga.
Say we get the green light. You know, are people going to be flocking back to group fitnesses right away? Like, there's still going to be some fear. Like, is it really gone?
That was Christy Quaid. She owns Pure Love Yoga in San Clemente.
So, Emily, what about these special loans for small businesses that were part of the stimulus package? I mean, shouldn't they be available soon to help these small businesses pay the rent?
Yes, they should. And these are Small Business Administration loans, and they will forgive whatever part of the money you use to pay your rent, to pay your employees and your utilities. And I'm not exaggerating when I say millions of small business owners are applying for these loans right now. And if you are one of them, I would love to talk to you about how it's going. So please get in touch.
That's KPCC's Emily Guerin. You can find her on Twitter at Guerin Emily. That's G-U-E-R-I-N Emily. Emily, thanks.
Thank you, A.
All right, it is the first of the month, and just like small business owners, millions of California residents will have to pay rent for the first time during the coronavirus pandemic, and many of them will not be able to. About a third of LA renters were already spending half their income or more on housing, and that was before many lost their jobs. KPCC's David Wagner looks at what this means for renters and their landlords.
Studio City renter Juliet Zimmerman works as a hairdresser. She started losing work early on.
It was already slowing down the minute the coronavirus was on the news and making headlines.
Then non-essential businesses were ordered to shut down, so her salon closed.
It has completely stopped any income.
Like many workers in LA, Zimmerman lives paycheck to paycheck. At this point, she doesn't have the money to cover her rent in April. She applied for unemployment insurance 2 weeks ago, but still hasn't heard back. She's been talking with her landlord about making partial payments, but she's not sure what she can even afford right now.
You don't necessarily want to take, like, hey, here's the last $50 in my account and give it to rent because you might need that for food.
She hopes to come up with a long-term repayment plan, but for now, she can't say when she'll be able to catch up.
It's just a lot of stress on top of too much uncertainty and no income. There's no definitive answer I could give because there's no answer for anybody right now.
I want to be as forgiving as possible, but you know, there's no such thing as free rent.
Gary Dean Rupsaman owns the fourplex where Zimmerman lives. He and his wife treat the property as basically their retirement plan. They still have a mortgage on the building, and they need the rent to cover the monthly payments.
Rent is crazy important, especially right now when my other source of income looks like it's gone away.
As a realtor, Rupsaman's job is also pretty much on hold. He can't do any in-person showings. He's not opening any escrow accounts. For April, he plans to dip into his own savings to cover the mortgage.
I'm going to pay my bills as long as I can, and I will do whatever it takes to pay my bills.
He could reach out to his mortgage lender to ask about delaying payments. Banks in California have agreed to a 90-day grace period for mortgage borrowers hit by economic fallout from the coronavirus. But Rupsaman worries about what might happen if his tenants can't pay for months on end.
For this month, you know, what I'm saying to my tenants, like Juliet, pay what you can. Try not to get too far behind in rent because it's going to be really tough to recover once you get past this.
His experience tells him that if tenants get too deep in debt, they'll just leave.
I'm not a corporation with staff attorneys that can go after recover that money in the future. It will just be gone.
While some LA landlords, like Rupsaman, are trying to work out a plan with their tenants, others are not so accommodating. Renters have sent us letters they're getting from their landlords. Some are saying rent is still due, in full, on the first of the month, no exceptions. Those letters don't mention eviction moratoriums passed at the local or state level for Californians who can't pay because of coronavirus-related hardship. The moratoriums could help keep people in their homes, but they put the burden of proof on renters, who need to show they've lost income due to the coronavirus. Chancellor Al-Mansour with the Housing Rights Center says renters need to be proactive about their rights, even when their landlords are sending them misleading information.
If you don't think you can pay all of the rent or some of the rent, immediately notify your landlord in writing that you need additional time to pay rent, that you won't be able to pay the rent because you have lost income because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The new eviction rules still require tenants to repay their back rent. Renters in the city of LA will have 12 months to get caught up. Richard Green, director of the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate, says if renters can't pay, someone is ultimately going to take a financial hit.
I think this is why we need to think carefully about how we help everybody in this crisis. Giving households money to help them pay the rent, that helps a lot. But for some of these small owners, if this lasts more than a couple of months, we're going to have to think about what policies we can use to help them out. I really don't have a good idea for that at the moment.
More than a million Californians have already filed for unemployment. Missed rent payments could be widespread. With the first of the month now here, Green says we're about to find out just how widespread. Covering the economy, I'm David Wagner.
A few days ago, we heard about the lengths some business owners are going to stay open. One of them was Queenie Reed, co-owner of the restaurant Poppy and Rose in downtown LA. Just like many others who saw their dining business plummet, she decided to sell some hard-to-find groceries to customers, things such as onions, eggs, even toilet paper. She relied on her supplier connections to become a de facto market.
The response was overwhelming. We started having people calling and placing orders, and it's also helped with takeout too. They'll end up ordering about $50 or $60 worth of to-go food as well.
But a lot has changed in the past few days. Since we last talked to Reed, the LA County Health Department began to shut down these kinds of operations. But then just yesterday, lawmakers stepped in to help bring back this lifeline for many eateries in town. Let's bring on someone who's been taking the lead on this, and that's Janice Hahn, LA County Supervisor, whose district includes Long Beach, the South Bay, and Whittier. Supervisor, welcome back.
Thanks, A. Glad to be here.
Now, you directed the health department to devise a guideline so that restaurants can sell groceries safely. Why do you think it's important that restaurants be able to have this option in these times?
Well, we're all in this crisis together, and we're all doing everything we can to, number one, protect the public's health and try to stop the spread of this virus. But the other thing we're trying to do is help small businesses, restaurants, and others stay afloat during this time. And if there's any way we can work with them to keep their business open, keep their employees employed, maybe we can really get through this without a lot of people losing their jobs. So I thought there was an opportunity to sort of find a compromise between a restaurant just becoming a full-on grocery store and yet having to close their door. So I think the Department of Public Health will come up with a good compromise that restaurants can begin selling items that they already are ordering from their vendors but just haven't been able to use to capacity. Like, say they bought, you know, they've got too much, too many tomatoes or lettuce or carrots, they're not cooking them and because people aren't dining in as much as they used to. Maybe that's an opportunity. Box those up and sell them directly to the consumer.
Well, let's talk about that compromise, because in interviews, Barbara Ferrer, the county's director of public health, said, quote, "I appreciate all of the innovation, but grocery stores are licensed, and anyone who wants to be a grocery store does need to get licensed." So, Supervisor, can you explain to us the difference in licensing? Because a restaurant basically takes all those items that we buy from grocery stores and then prepares them. So wondering what the issue is.
So, yes, and, you know, in the beginning, she was very hard line about restaurants just opening up tomorrow as a grocery store. But again, that's why I stepped in, because I felt like there was somewhere in between that we could keep them operating but protect the public's health. And so, for instance, you know, grocery stores, their layout is clearly larger. There's an opportunity for people to still socially distance themselves while they're in the grocery store. Many of them have already marked off the 6 feet lines in between when you're standing in line. So some of these restaurants, their floor plan clearly is smaller. It wasn't designed to have people shopping inside their restaurants for groceries. So we felt like a good compromise would be for them to take the products and the produce that they already have and figure out a way that they can just sell that directly to the consumer. If they want to become a full-fledged grocery store, they would have to go back through the state and look at a whole new permitting procedure. And I wanted to prevent them having to do that, and let's find something in between that works. You know, some of them could become like meal prep operations.
Okay.
Where instead of, you know, cooking the meal in the restaurant, they put all the ingredients together in a box, give it to you and say, okay, go home and try your hand at this.
But let's just say a restaurant does have a lot of tomatoes, as you mentioned, tomatoes and onions. Could they set it up the way it would be in the produce aisle at a grocery store, at least for the time being? So have the tomatoes on one table, the onions on another table, because I can already see how that could lead to what I'm sure you don't want, is people getting together close enough to be within 6 feet of each other.
Right. I think a better option, which again, our public health folks are going to come up with these guidelines, but I think a better option would be to put these kinds of things on their menu, on their takeout menu.
Mm.
So when you look at their takeout menu, you could order a box of tomatoes or a box of carrots or some onions or rice or beans or whatever. But the restaurant would do the packing up of those items and put them in a box, and then you would then pick them up at curbside or maybe even have them delivered. I think that will probably be a safer option, so that, again, we have somewhere in between shutting them down and then in any way, harming the public's health or their employees. We want their employees to be safe as well. So we're trying to keep everybody distance from each other. And I think this is a compromise that could really work for them.
When can restaurants hear about these compromises, or when can they find out something more definitive on when what they can do and when they can do it?
Well, it was just yesterday that I ordered the Department of Public Health to come up with these guidelines. But I do know we've all been thinking about this since we first started getting calls in our offices about our health department shutting these places down. So my office has been working on it with our county officials. So I'm hopeful, and was my desire, that they came back this week, at least within 7 days, and gave these guidelines. We're in a tough, tough situation. Number one, a lot of these restaurants are within, you know, moments of going under. They're within moments of laying off people. I want to stop that in any way possible so we can keep them, opening and paying their employees, so we don't have other people who are going into unemployment.
Yeah.
And also, the community needs to be fed. And that's something that I know restaurants, you know, that's their mission in life, is to feed people good food. So I want to keep that chain flowing from their vendors, so their vendors also don't go out of business, so they can continue to order the food.
Yeah, there's so many parts to this, right? Yeah.
There are so many parts to it, but I'm trying to do my part in trying to keep it all continuing to flow, so that somehow our economy can limp along.
That's LA County Supervisor Janice Hahn. Thank you very much.
Thank you, A.
All right, more Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Excuse me, 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Census Day is finally upon us, and so far California isn't off to a bad start. According to the Census Bureau, about 36% of Californians have completed their surveys. But that number is just an average. In the state's historically undercounted communities, participation continues to lag. Many engagement groups have been hard at work, often going door to door to raise awareness about the count. But the advent of COVID-19 and the subsequent shelter-in-place orders have hampered those efforts. So, on this census day, how are those groups adapting? Let's get some answers from two of them. Lene Norwood is the spokesperson for the California Black Census and Redistricting Hub and creator of the My Black Counts campaign. Welcome to you, Lene.
Hi, thank you.
And David Aguila is Youth Civic Engagement Organizer at Inner City Struggle. Welcome to you as well, David.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Lene, let's start with you. First and foremost, I want to drill home what's at stake in all this. So could you just give us a brief overview of some of the things that the census data is used for and how it affects the communities that you work with?
Sure. Census data is critical to all the residents of California and throughout the nation. Census data on a national level funds and directs resources for 316 federal programs. And in the state of California, it directs funding and resources for 55 public programs. Some of those programs include unemployment insurance. We saw last week that 3.3 million residents in California filed for unemployment, and the amount of resource that's available in that pool of money and support for communities that have been impacted is directly tied to 2010 census results and participation. So unemployment, school lunches, food assistance programs like SNAP and CalFresh, access to affordable or free health care like Medi-Cal and Medicaid. Those are just a handful of the 55 programs here in California that are funded by census data.
David, I think Lene covered all of it, but you have anything to add that maybe she missed?
No, I think she covered it all.
Perfect, perfect. All right, now, Lene, I mentioned the global pandemic has thrown a wrench, really, in the plans that groups such as yours have made. What did your outreach groups or actually outreach efforts look like before COVID-19, and how have they maybe changed in recent weeks?
Yes. So the challenge that we have in California is that historically, residents in California have been undercounted. There are a broad diversity of hard-to-count or traditionally known as hard-to-count communities in California that represent the diversity of California via ethnicity, nationality, socioeconomic status, education level, household makeup. So specifically for the Black community, we have found through previous civic engagement programs that one of the most effective methods of reaching communities that either have been marginalized or overlooked or have government mistrust is to knock on their door.
Yeah.
So prior to COVID, we were knocking on doors, having one-to-one conversations with households throughout California in key regions where there's a high density of African-American population. In addition to that, for the households where we didn't have foot soldiers on the ground, we were dialing through phone banking, making sure that we were making individual calls to tens of thousands of households throughout the state, hundreds of thousands. So COVID has definitely presented some challenges with our shelter-in-place orders, our safer in home orders from our governor, where now we cannot participate in civic engagement outreach in the traditional methods that we formerly utilized prior to this pandemic. So things have definitely changed.
David, what about you with Inner City Struggle? How have things changed for you?
Pretty much the exact same way. Kind of to echo what was previously said is that one of the most effective methods that we found to sort of convince folks to participate in the census was to basically do door-to-door outreach, face-to-face interactions. Another reason for this being was that when we try to do other forms of outreach, whether it be digital, phone banking, or text banking, we're relying on database of voters or a database of folks to do that outreach. And again, that's going to be missing some of those hard-to-count, traditionally hard-to-count communities, right? A lot of folks that are new to the area, new to this country, might not know that they need to participate in the census, right? And we were really relying on the door-to-door, face-to-face interaction strategy
to get them mobilized and to get them to participate in the census. Now that we've had to shift to with everything happening with COVID-19, we have to look at different approaches, primarily digital strategies, to get folks counted.
And for you, David, the added layer, too, is that you focus a lot on the east side of Los Angeles. You got places like East L.A., Lincoln Heights, Boyle Heights. And so there's a language layer as well.
That's correct. And, you know, being door to door, having somebody that speaks their language in front of them and also somebody that they see themselves in is really, really powerful when it comes to delivering a message and getting it. Having them sort of adopt that message.
David, when it comes to that digital strategy, though, because I know you focus a lot on that as well, if you can't see someone face-to-face, how difficult is it to connect? How difficult is it to get people to participate if you can't talk to them in front of you?
So if you're thinking about it in terms of a like Facebook paid ad strategy, that's 100% true. But some other strategies that we're trying to employ is relational organizing. So it is a form of digital organizing in that it primarily takes place in the digital space. And the way that this organizing primarily takes place is that you would download an app and that app would effectively go through all of your contacts and it would send a curated message from your phone number to all of your personal contacts. That way, when those folks receive that message, they're not receiving the message from a randomly generated number. They're receiving that message from one of their peers. So although the traditional Facebook ad approach isn't really good at getting deep interactions, we're hoping that these new methods will sort of help fill in those gaps.
Lene, I know that with a lot of communities of color, especially in Black communities, there's mistrust surrounding government, and it can be hard to persuade people to participate in a census without being there in person, as we've been mentioning. But I'm wondering for you, Lene, when you do have to do some heavy persuading, what are you hearing from people about what their biggest concerns are?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Government mistrust is a significant barrier in persuading residents in California, really throughout the country, to take the census in the Black community. One of the biggest concerns we've heard is about privacy or sharing information or information being used in retaliation to families who may be receiving social services or may be justice impacted or had encounters with law enforcement or the IRS. So the real number one topic of concern that we hear, I don't want to say number one, but one of the highest topics of concern that we hear in our feedback in so many different ways is just like, I don't want to share my information because I don't trust that it's secure and it's safe.
Wow. We're talking to Lene Norwood, spokesperson for the California Black Census and Redistricting Hub, and also creator of the My Black Counts campaign. Also, David Aguila, youth civic engagement organizer at Inner City Struggle. So, Lene, really quick, so how are you getting around those concerns? How are you figuring out a way to ease that concern?
Yeah. Our whole campaign is really built out of a strategy that utilizes trusted messengers. Our coalition of 35 organizations throughout the state have been on the forefront of several social justice and racial justice issues to advocate for equity throughout Black and Brown communities. So they have a track record of success and relationships in the regions that they are reaching out to spread the word about the census. And by being connecting our campaign, My Black Counts, to those organizations and being a part of that body, that just brings a credibility factor to information. In addition to that, just, you know, dealing with misinformation and addressing it head on and providing sources and information that validates, you know, the claims that we make. For example, your census data is protected, and that's actually protected by Title 13, which is a U.S. code that prevents anyone who works for the Census Department for sharing your information, and consequences for that are quite severe. So pointing to that as like, hey, there are safeties and controls in place to make sure that your information is safe and secure. This is just, and then also driving it in and helping people understand and conceptualize what census data really is. It's a numerical count. It's a value representation. It's not about your individual identity so much. It's about the data of your household and what that looks like.
And on that, David, I mean, I'm wondering if you are worried right now about your ability to reach enough people to prevent an undercount.
Without a doubt, that's a very, very real fear. You know, as we mentioned earlier, canvassing was going to be our most robust form of outreach, the one that was going to kind of fill in all the cracks that we were going to be missing. So considering now that we have to primarily pivot to primarily a digital-based strategy, it's really, really nerve-wracking. The one, I guess I would say, silver lining to all of this is that folks, I'd hate to say this, folks do have a little bit more free time on their hands. So now they do have the ability to kind of like participate in the census due to the amount of time that they have access.
But that's legit, David. I mean, it's true. It's absolutely true. So yeah, I mean, use the time wisely, right?
Yeah, I don't like to celebrate the fact that celebrate the reason why folks have a lot of free time.
Oh, but people, yeah, we understand though. Yeah, we get it.
But it's true. We do have a lot of free time, and hopefully that will lead to a lot more folks responding, a lot more folks interacting into the social media space, seeing these messages being put out and participating in the census.
One thing, David, I think many will remember the Trump administration's efforts last year to add a citizenship question to the census. In June, the Supreme Court decided to keep the question off, but the Bureau predicted that leaving the question on was likely to reduce census responses among households with at least one non-citizen by at least 8 percentage points. So based on the people, David, that you've talked to, is there still an effect from that push?
Not so much. There still is that skepticism and that fear of participating in these government programs, especially for folks that have different documentation statuses or mixed statuses in their families. But I feel like there was a really great job done emphasizing the fact that the question was not going to be included in the census. So that's a question that we don't really get too often anymore. We were getting question a lot during the summertime last year, but now we feel as if folks are pretty certain that the citizenship question is not going to be included, although that doesn't deter folks from being scared to participate just because of their citizenship status. So we still like to reiterate and reinform them that the citizenship question is not going to be asked on the census and that there's no way that they can sort of make assumptions as to your status based on information that you're providing in the census.
Well, at least you're halfway there on that, right? I mean, before, yeah, I've talked to you before. You've had the struggle all the way through, and now at least halfway there. Lenny, real quick, a lot of people are listening to us from a computer right now. Many, maybe some haven't filled out their census forms yet. So in the last, say, 30 seconds here, could you quickly walk people through how to do it right now if they have a computer screen in front of them?
Yes, great idea. So the census is really fast. You can take your census in less than 10 minutes. It's 9 questions. Visit myblackcounts.org/2020census, and that will take you directly to a page with further instructions or connect you right to the census online portal where you can take your census. Again, myblackcounts.org/2020census.
Lene Norwood.
Minutes,
perfect. Lene Norwood is the spokesperson for the California Black Census and Redistricting Hub, creator of the My Black Counts campaign. And David Aguila is youth civic engagement organizer at Inner City Struggle. Lene, David, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Take your census, guys.
All right. Hollywood, as you know, is on pause. I mean, every TV production, every movie production, even reality shows are taking a break because obviously you can't do much with COVID-19 in the air. But Hollywood has had to deal with this before, actually about 100 years ago. We'll get into how they got over it back then and any lessons they learned then applying to today. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
I've been a fool for you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Really quick, the White House Coronavirus Task Force daily briefing is just getting underway. If you'd like to hear it, just go to laist.com. That's laist.com. Now, executives are foregoing salaries in the wake of coronavirus losses. Theaters have closed, and the entire industry, the Hollywood movie-making industry, has really felt like it's come to a halt. But it isn't the first time that Hollywood has been through this. It's time for a little history, so let's go on the lot.
Your head out and yell. You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
And our guide, as always, is the Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the entertainment biz. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right. Now, ever since COVID-19 reached a pandemic level, there's been a lot of comparisons to 1918's Spanish flu. So let's zero in on the similarities between 1918 and today as they relate to Hollywood. So first, some context, Rebecca. What was the state of the movie industry before the 1918 pandemic struck?
Well, it was just in its early days. The silent film industry was taking off. A lot of the business of Hollywood was on the East Coast. But it was becoming an increasingly important industry to the country, right up there with agriculture, coal, steel, and many of the iconic actors of the silent era were at work. Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, all of those folks.
And for a long time, actually for some time, the flu wasn't seen as a real threat, at least here on the West Coast. Why not?
Well, it did start in the East, but it made its way to L.A. in the fall of 1918. The first case here was October 1st. In those early days, theaters were still open. Some theater owners were giving out gauze masks to patrons. Sid Grauman, who we have to thank for the beautiful Chinese and Egyptian theaters in Hollywood, told the L.A. Times that he had, quote, yet to hear a sneeze in any of his theaters. So there was some sense in the early days that they were going to carry on. But there was also a growing awareness of the seriousness about the theaters were half empty across the U.S. and there was an embargo on the release of new films.
So when was the turning point? I mean, when did things start to get serious for Hollywood?
Well, on October 11th, so not that long after the first case hit the city of L.A. ordered theaters shut until further notice. So there were 83 movie theaters closed here, and eventually production of new films was affected as well. And popular actors were beginning to get infected on set. So that made the crisis real for the industry.
Who were the big names back then? Because I know celebrities today, they tweet out, you know, that they have it and they keep people updated. But back then, who were the big names that caught the flu and maybe succumbed to it?
Well, there was a screen heartthrob named Harold Lockwood who died of the flu at age 31. And there were others who contracted it and lived. Actress Lillian Gish, screenwriter Frances Marion. Walt Disney, who had not yet moved to town and started his studio, he was just 17 at the time, but he got the flu and obviously survived.
Wow. Well, that's one of the biggest names possible, right?
Yeah. Right, but he wasn't yet. He was just a kid at that point.
Any parallels between how studios were affected then and how they're affected today?
Well, a lot. I mean, first of all, they lost the revenue from the movie theaters then as they have now. Of course, then there was no TV or streaming providing other sources of revenue. Hollywood also stopped production largely then as now. And, you know, Cecil B. DeMille and D.W. Griffith could not have Zoom meetings with their department heads. So when it was stopped, it was stopped. But some small studios made kind of impassioned pleas to lawmakers that they ought to be able to continue to work, in part because so much movie production happened outdoors.
Wondering, because I guess all of us now are waiting for the time that we can all go back to normal, which would mean that Hollywood goes back to normal. What kind of precautions do they take to try and prevent spreading the illness? Because I would imagine that even though the influenza hadn't slowed, studios back then eventually returned to work.
They did. I mean, even as, you know, by late October, some production work resumed. And there were some things that they did, like crowd scenes were banned, and groups of onlookers who gathered to watch filming were sort of shooed along. Security guards at some of the studios would spray visitors down with disinfectant. Some studios gave out masks, but people at the time complained that they interfered with their cigarette smoking. So, you know,
A different time.
Priorities.
Yeah,
yes.
Much, much different time in America. We're talking to Rebecca Keegan. This is On the Lot every Wednesday. She joins us to talk about the entertainment business. All right, now let's move on to present day. In a move that mirrors what some actors and actresses did during the 1918 pandemic, executives are foregoing their salaries in the wake of coronavirus losses. Who is doing this and what's their reasoning been?
Well, probably the most noteworthy person doing it is former Disney CEO Bob Iger, who made $47 million last year and is foregoing his entire salary this year, as is the company's new CEO, Bob Chapek, will take a 50% pay cut to his base salary. Other people at high levels at the company are having salary reductions as well. The CEO of Cinemark, which is a theater chain, is also giving up his salary. So is Ari Emanuel, the CEO of Endeavor, the agency. And, you know, the intentions at each company are different, but largely the hope is to keep lower wage workers like theme park workers, movie theater chain staffers on the payroll at a time when theme parks and movie theaters themselves are closed.
I was wondering, yeah, because that's the thing. How helpful will this be for the workers of these companies? Is their salaries enough to cover some of what these workers might be losing?
Well, the money is real, and so too is the symbolism. I mean, these wealthy CEOs have a much bigger cushion to weather the financial impact of this downturn than some of their lower paid employees who may be living paycheck to paycheck.
All right, now to a study that surveyed 1,000 consumers in the U.S., Rebecca. What were the participants asked, and what were its findings?
Well, a company called Performance Research asked people essentially how willing they're going to be to leave the house for big public events once it's deemed safe again to do so. 44% of people said they would attend fewer large public events, even once they're cleared by the CDC. 47% agreed that the idea of going to a major public event, quote, will scare me for a long time. And 49% said it'll take a few months to possibly never for them to return to movie theaters.
I gotta admit, Rebecca, so I've gone back and forth on this. You know how much I love going to the movies, especially on the opening weekend of a movie that I want to see. But I got little granddaughters, too, that I take to some of these events, too. I'm thinking about just maybe waiting. So say like a big movie like Wonder Woman 1984 comes out, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to wait 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month before I go to that movie just to thin out the crowd in the theater.
So even you, the sort of big opening weekend guy,
yeah,
is being affected by this. It clearly, you're not alone based on these numbers. It does make me think a little bit of when after 9/11, when people were reluctant to fly for a while and eventually they did return in large numbers. I hope that will happen for public events. I know I love them. You know, movies, concerts, baseball games, that stuff is so fun.
We all got to get back on that Hollywood horse, but safely, I would think. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the business of entertainment. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, we talked earlier on the show about how today is rent day and how rent maybe won't have to pay it for at least a little while. But how about canceling it? A big name musician says, yes, cancel all rent. Find out who it is and why he's saying that when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The coronavirus and the safer at home order that's been imposed because of it has shut down businesses everywhere. And that means many Angelenos are out of a job and unable to pay rent this month. It has many calling for rent to be essentially canceled. That includes L.A. Councilman Mike Bonin. He'll be on the program tomorrow to talk about it. But it's not just the lawmakers. Musician and activist Allo Black has a plan to help as well. And it involves a throwback to a tradition called the Rent Party. Allo Black, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, okay, so tell us what is the Cancel Rent Fest and why are you doing it?
Cancel Rent Festival is a group that we've created between Artivist Entertainment, Right to the City, and Beyond Recovery. We've enlisted some musicians, some speakers, and other kinds of artists and activists to spread the word about fighting for canceling rent, to recognize that they should be fighting for this very basic human right, the dignity of being able to live debt-free when the government is telling them not to go to work.
Yeah, and that is the problem, right? Because, yeah, if people can't go to work, they obviously can't make rent. So to have rent being imposed on them in this time, I mean, that's a tricky situation.
Sure. And it's interesting because in Los Angeles, we've had the opportunity to get the ear of council and the mayor, and they've done a moratorium on rent. But listen, you know, you like to use the analogy of a train. If one car stops, all the cars have to stop. Otherwise, there'll be a train wreck. And if the income that is going to tenants stops and they're not able to pay their rent, then the landlord is not able to pay his mortgage. And this is also an issue where there needs to be a moratorium on mortgage, not just a moratorium, it needs to be canceled because it's really, you're losing time and you're not going to get that time back.
Now, okay, so for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about the history of rent parties.
So rent parties were a way for the community around you to uplift and hold you up for that moment. You would have a party in your apartment. All of your friends and locals would come over, and maybe some people you don't know, pay a little bit of money to get in, and that money would be what you use to pay rent for that month. It exists in many different places. My parents come from Panama. They called it a susu. Like, everybody would put their money into the pot, and yeah, for that one week or that one month or whatever it is, that person was the hero. So in the tradition of a rent party, we would offer basically a donation to one friend so that they could pay rent for that month, and it would go around and everybody benefited from it. In this case, we're throwing this festival, this party, to cancel rent. So we're just using the concept. We're just flipping it on its head.
Now, we have a clip loaded up from your performance this past Sunday at Cancel Rent Fest. It's a cover of a song by Bill Withers.
I just might have a problem that you'd understand. We all need somebody to lean on me.
Now, first off, Aloe, if that's what we're getting with this festival, I think it's impossible not to be able to get up and dance, even though you're doing it on the screen. But I'm guessing you chose Lean On Me for obvious reasons. Tell me about the backing track on this, because I understand it was provided by youth musicians from South L.A.
Yes, a really wonderful human being named Fernando Pullum in South L.A. For many decades, has been working with youth, teaching them instruments and creating an orchestra of students in South LA. Many students have graduated out of his orchestra, but he continues. And I thought it was an awesome idea to work with those students, create a few songs that they could put on their next album. Lean On Me is one of them. And I was so happy to have the opportunity to record with these amazing budding musicians and artists.
Now, we're talking to our musician and activist, Aloe Black. Now, I can see the appeal of reviving the concept with so many people out of work. But, of course, this has to be a virtual rent party. So how are you pulling off Cancel Rent Fest in this time of physical distancing?
Well, you know, all of the artists that have invited to do this, Kitsal Trio, Maya Jupiter, Georgia Ann Muldrow, we all have a way of entertaining. So doing it through the computer screen is basically just giving us a different audience and a different way to interact. But you're going to get the music, you're going to get the energy, and hopefully at home you'll be dancing and singing along.
Now, you mentioned earlier how the city council in LA went forward with rent moratorium. But what's the difference between rent moratorium and canceling rent?
So a moratorium is kind of is like postponing and putting it off till later, where a cancellation is saying you don't owe it ever. And the reason why there's a big issue here is because the moratorium allows for renters to be able to say that they were unable to pay rent for reasons caused by the COVID-19 epidemic. And that all makes sense. But the moratorium says that 6 months after this state of emergency, you will owe all of the rent that you have not paid. And that is going to be quite difficult, if not impossible, for the majority of people in Los Angeles alone. About 60% of the population are renters, and they're not going to get that time back that they lost from going to work. So it doesn't make any logical sense. The way I see it, if the banks are getting the bailout, they can absorb all of the costs at the end of the line where tenants and mortgage holders are unable to pay. The U.S. government is giving the money to the bank. But guess who gave the money to the U.S. government? The tenants and the mortgage holders through taxes. So in a real way, it really is our money.
And you mentioned earlier some of the people that you got together with for this. Tell us how all of these artists that you mentioned, how do they all come together for it?
So I started an organization with my wife, a friend of ours named Quetzal Flores, who's part of the Grammy Award-winning band Quetzal, and a couple of other artists and activists within Los Angeles. And Quetzal is often in many different activist circles. He had the connection to Right to the City. They really wanted to create an action and an event around Cancel Rent, and Artivist Entertainment really was the team to help pull together all of the artivists to perform at this festival.
Now, you know, musicians have also lost their ability to perform and offer services. I mean, there's no concerts happening anywhere. There's no clubs that are offering space right now for people to perform. What are your plans, number one, for the future, Allo? And how do you think artists should be responding right now, considering everything going on, but also considering that musicians need to play music? They need to express themselves. It seems like it's a weird time for everyone.
I call on my artist family, all of the entertainers and celebrities who've had the opportunity to make a decent living from doing this, to support their fans who, at the end of this, even when we do get a chance to start performing again, may not be able to afford tickets to our concerts. I think when the wheels start turning again, things will be quite different. You know, a lot of venues will be closed up because they are missing so much income. When it's time to get back to work, I don't know that they'll be able to. So we're looking for real relief here, relief that is sustainable. And canceling rent and mortgage is really the only way I see it.
That's musician Allo Black. His Cancel Rent Festival is streaming on YouTube Live every day through April 6th. Allo, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Feeling my way through the darkness, guided by a beating heart. I can't tell where the journey will end, but I know where to start. They tell me
I'm all right. If you missed any part of Take Two today, you could always go find us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're at Take Two on Twitter. That's at Take Two. And I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.